Time now for the Board of News Roundup. Friday mornings, we get a chance to check in with Marshall Helmberger, the publisher and editor of the Timberjay, a newspaper serving northeastern Minnesota. Marshall, good to talk to you again.
Happy to be here, Heidi.
Well, let's start off with another story involving PolyMet, this time some comments from environmental groups to the DNR after the report. Give us kind of a reminder of what that report was and what's going on now.
Sure. Well, this was, it's known as a, in technical terms, it's a 43-101 report. It's a technical kind of feasibility report, essentially, that was issued. And PolyMet has actually had a couple of these come out over the years, but they had an updated version, and the numbers were much different, including the financial numbers, were much less rosy than some of the earlier versions of this feasibility report. And that has prompted a lot of concern about the economic viability of the project, you know, whether you're going to find investment capital to move a project like this forward. It's also raised questions from the environmental community about whether or not the company is going to be able to find the revenue to fund the financial assurance requirements in the permit to mine, which, you know, they're currently hoping to receive. It's currently out in draft form. You know, the DNR had issued that earlier this year. And right now, the environmental groups have petitioned the DNR to have a contested case hearing or proceeding. That would be before an administrative law judge. And they're saying there's a number of areas where they don't think that the DNR has the facts right, and they want to be able to bring in some, you know, their own expert testimony in order to try to challenge some of the conclusions that the DNR has made. Obviously, this latest technical report and the financial numbers are raising a lot more alarm, I think, on the environmental side. The problems with this latest report is it showed that the initial costs of construction on the project have gone up a lot, up to about $1 billion just for the first phase of the project. Also, substantially lower financial return on the project. So now there's the question about whether the project will be built, and also about how they're going to finance their financial assurance obligations. You know, and just to give you an example, as part of the financial assurance that PolyMet would have to provide, just for the long-term maintenance and water treatment on the plant after closure, they would have to put up about $580 million in cash, you know, to help finance a trust fund that would be established for that purpose. The problem is when you look at the cash flow model now that's in this technical report that PolyMet has put out, it doesn't show those payments. And so, you know, the question is, well, what happens to your cash flow model if you start to actually show those payments? And obviously it's not going to be as rosy as even they're portraying. So, you know, how does that impact the overall, you know, financial return on the project? And is there going to be enough money to be able to do what the company's promising? So these are all, you know, complicated questions, which I think some of these environmental groups now are hoping that they can explore in a lot greater depth if they get into a contested case proceeding. Now, the DNR would have to allow that. You know, the DNR could say, no, we're not going to do a contested case proceeding. In that case, you know, groups who want that would certainly have the option of taking a case, you know, to court. Whether the groups would do that or not remains to be seen. One of the other issues, though, that I think that's come up is this technical study also made it clear that the financial returns of the project could be bolstered by substantially increasing the size of the mine and also the rate at which the ore is mined. Essentially, quadrupling the rate of mining on the site would substantially increase the financial returns. And so it's been alleged now by some of these environmental groups that this is almost a bait and switch kind of a thing here. You know, that, you know, PolyMet came forward with this proposal, you know, as a smaller footprint, smaller mine, a lower rate of mining, so you're not going to be dealing with as much waste. And now it turns out, oh, no, it's going to have to be four times the size to be profitable. That raises some concerns there about whether or not, you know, the company was as straightforward and transparent moving forward in developing, you know, their proposal as they maybe could have been. PolyMet says they have been from the beginning. That would be another one of these issues, though, that could come up and be explored, I think, in a little more depth in a contested case. So the big question at this point is whether or not the DNR will be doing that. The DNR also indicates that they do plan to have their own financial consultants take an in-depth look at this latest technical report from PolyMet, and they will probably have some questions as well. In fact, I mean, I know the financial consultant for the state has raised a number of questions in the past about some of the proposals that PolyMet's put forward, and I would imagine, given the less optimistic numbers that came out with this latest report, I'm sure those questions will probably intensify.
Not great news for PolyMet.
No, I think the project is definitely has taken a hit here. And I think that's also indicative in the stock price, which has not responded favorably, I would say, to the release of this technical report.
Another story you've been covering about a deer study that the DNR is engaged in. Where do they want to study the deer and why?
There are actually three locations where they're doing this study, and they're using GPS collars on female deer. And they're studying a group in southeastern Minnesota, and I think they have a different mission for some of what they're looking to find there. But also, they're studying a group of deer around the Longville area, and then one more up in our neck of the woods around Elephant Lake, which is up north of Orr. And, you know, I think in every single location, they're going to have slightly different questions that they're going to be looking at, but also just trying to get a better sense of how deer in different parts of the state, you know, utilize habitat, particularly in winter, which is, you know, kind of the key survival time of year for deer. And one of the questions I know that some of the local wildlife managers up in our area are hoping to find out about is why deer are not recovering as quickly in some of these deer permit areas right up by the border, you know, around Crane Lake, Elephant Lake, International Falls, basically, you know, kind of far northern St. Louis County. And they have not seen the kind of recovery in the deer herd that we've seen in other parts of the state with the past few mild winters. One of the concerns that I know some of the local wildlife managers have is that that area has been, it's kind of right in the heart of, you know, the Boise Cascade Mills wood basket. And it's been logged pretty intensively for years, and they're concerned that maybe there's not enough winter habitat. I mean, generally, you know, deer seem to do well in young forest, but only to an extent. As Tom Rush, our Tower Area DNR wildlife manager, likes to say, you know, that they need food, but they also need cover, particularly in winter. So, you know, that's been their theory for a long time, that maybe there's been too much cutting, and they're cutting the forest stands too young, so it doesn't get the opportunity to develop some of the types of trees, particularly balsam fir and cedar and pine, that provide that winter protection for deer. And so they're hoping that this study will allow them to bring some data forward. When they have their discussions with foresters about, you know, setting up timber sales, maybe they'll have some more data to kind of bolster their arguments for maybe letting a stand grow a little bit longer, or, you know, maybe leaving some areas that have more of the kind of cover that deer are looking for. And I should mention the collars they're putting on these deer are GPS collars, and that will allow the DNR to really monitor the deer on, you know, almost in a real-time basis as they just go about, you know, their business out there in the woods. So they'll be able to track much more closely than they've been able to do in the past, you know, exactly what kind of habitat the deer are utilizing at various points of the day, at various points in the year. So it should be some really good data, and I know that the local wildlife managers are very excited to kind of see how it all shakes out.
All right. Marshall, before we go, let's get the scoop on how much ice is out there. What does opening fishing look like?
Looks like you better bring your ice auger, I would say, at this point, at least on a lot of lakes. And nobody I've spoken to in the past week is at all optimistic that we're going to have a whole lot of open water by the time fishing opener comes on May 12th. It's not that far away, just a month away. But there's a lot of ice that's got to melt between now and then. You know, I was out on Stunts Bay, which is on Lake Vermilion. It's right by the Lake Vermilion State Park. And I just drove out onto the bay the other day with my ice auger because I was curious to see how much ice there was out there. And there was 34 inches in the one spot I drilled. I'm sure there's going to be places out on the lake where there's more than that. It's probably safe to say we've probably got about 3 feet or close to it on Vermilion right now, and it's rock-solid ice all the way through. It's going to take a lot to melt all that in the next month. And, you know, if we were looking at predictions of rain and, you know, temperatures in the 60s and overnight lows above freezing, you know, in the extended forecast, you know, you might start to think there's a possibility. But, you know, it's just like we're kind of stuck in this colder than normal rut, and you get, you know, every night it freezes again. So you don't really even start to touch, you know, the lake ice until you start getting, you know, overnight lows above freezing. And you got to melt the snow off the ice, and that's, you know, there's still plenty of snow out there. Once the snow is gone, then the sun can start working on the ice. But, boy, and until then, you're just not going to make much progress. So I'm not at all optimistic, which is too bad because losing fishing opener, you know, that's a big hit to the area. I mean, that's always a big influx of cash to lots of local businesses and kind of thing. You don't really get that back. We're hoping that maybe somehow that ice can disappear, but nobody I've talked to is optimistic. I did talk to John Nemesty. He's the owner of Aronson Boatworks on Vermilion's Pike Bay. He's been there for many years, and he's reasonably optimistic that they'll have open water on Pike Bay. That's usually the first part of Vermilion to open because that's where the Pike River comes in. It's a quite shallow bay, but that usually goes out about 10 days to 2 weeks before the rest of Lake Vermilion. And he's thinking probably the first week of May, maybe for Pike Bay. He's now thinking third week of May for the rest of the lake. So that would be well past opener. Now, our average ice out date on Vermilion is April 30th. So even in a average year, you know, we're looking at ice out not too much ahead of the fishing opener. So you get a late year and you can really be in trouble.
What was the last year where it was still ice for opener? Do you know? Is it 2013?
Actually, it was 2014.
14, okay.
Yeah, and we still had ice on opener the year before that. So both 2013 and 14, we had ice for opener. And so we may do it again here this year.
Marshall Helmberger, the Border News Roundup. You can read and see more at thetimberjay.com. Marshall, thanks so much. We'll check in next week.
Sounds great. Thanks, Heidi.
Now I'm a one-man jury. Oh, I got all the facts. Do you want to change your story? Well, now before the judge gets back, no one's calling you a liar, but you know.